16 years ago this week, President Ronald Reagan died. And most people today only remember him as president. But if you're, shall we say, more seasoned, then you'll remember Ronald Reagan as an actor during Hollywood's golden age. His most inspiring role was probably that of Notre Dame football player George the Gipper Gip in the film Newt Rockne, All-American. His least inspiring role was probably when he starred opposite of a chimpanzee in Bedtime for Bonzo. But in my research last week, I learned that he also played George Armstrong Custer in the film Santa Fe Trail. George Custer made his famous last stand at Little Bighorn at just 36 years of age. But he packed a lot into those 36 years, both good and bad. George Custer was born December 5th, 1839, in New Rumley, Ohio, and his personality was larger than life from the beginning. The poor little guy had to get a tooth pulled at just 4 years old. But as his father recalled, he didn't even cry. And he skipped home telling his father that he was so tough that there was no one he couldn't lay a whooping on. George loved playing practical jokes on his family members. And the practical joking continued when he enrolled in West Point. No one thought that George Custer would ever amount to anything as a military officer. He graduated in 1861 as the GOAT of the class, as the lowest-ranking cadet. With the record he compiled at West Point, under normal circumstances, he would have been sent to some obscure post to languish for the rest of his military career. But lucky for Custer, the Civil War had just broken out, and the Union Army was in desperate need of young officers. And Custer did not disappoint. As a cavalry officer, he was fearless in battle. Some would say reckless. Tradition has it that 11 horses were shot out from underneath him. Never one to shy away from the camera, the handsome mustachioed officer carefully crafted his public image. And it wasn't long until his superiors noticed his uncanny instincts in battle and his willingness to do whatever it took to get the job done. Then, in June of 1863, George Custer was promoted to Brigadier General. He was the youngest general in the Union Army at just 23 years of age, earning him the nickname Boy General. Can you imagine? And Custer picked the gaudiest general's uniform available. Some said it was a sign of his vanity. But Custer insisted on standing out on the battlefield for his men to see him leading the charge from the front. He refused to send others to do what he wasn't willing himself to do. But it was at Gettysburg that General Custer made a name for himself as he squared off against Jeb Stuart. Despite being outnumbered, Custer's brigade withstood charge after charge from Stuart's cavalry. Running out of ammunition, Custer's men repelled the Confederates in vicious hand-to-hand combat. And in the end, Custer threw off his hat so his men could recognize his long golden hair, and he drew a saber and led the final cavalry charge with such force that the collision caused many of the horses to tumble head over heels. Out of the 400 men in Custer's brigade, 247 were lost, but they forced Stuart to retreat. And it was the beginning of the end for the Confederate Army. The next year, Custer's cavalry blocked General Lee's final retreat. And General Custer was present at Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. As a matter of fact, the table on which the surrender was signed was gifted to Custer for his gallantry in battle, and it sits on display at the Smithsonian Institute today. And George Custer became a national hero. But the life of a military officer was much less glamorous after the war, and Custer's leadership ability started, some would say, to wane. Custer was assigned to the Western frontier to defend America's interests against the Indians. Actually, they were pushing the Native Americans off their own land as America continued to expand. And this is when Custer's reputation began to suffer. No one wanted to be on the Western frontier, including Custer's men. So he had to brutally discipline his band of malcontents to keep them in line. And he was criticized for shooting deserters without a trial. Then he viciously ransacked an Indian village in Cheyenne that resulted in the death of more than 40 women and children. These were some dark times in American history that happened with remarkable frequency. And of course, there was the incident at Little Bighorn in Montana. There's still a debate raging today over who's to blame for Custer's defeat there. Some believe that Custer led an irresponsible, foolhardy charge against the enemy, while others argue that he had no choice considering the orders he had been given. But one thing's for sure, in the end, Custer and every one of his men were cut down at the hands of the Lakota Sioux, including Custer's two younger brothers, his nephew, and his brother-in-law. The nation was shocked at the news of Custer's spectacular defeat. Some would say Custer deserved it for raiding and pillaging so many Native American settlements. But in the following years, his devoted wife Libby worked tirelessly to rehabilitate his public image through books and public lectures. Buffalo Bill Cody even incorporated a reenactment of Custer's last stand into his Wild West shows. And over time, Custer was reborn as one of our nation's greatest tragic heroes. But did he deserve that? What's the verdict on George Armstrong Custer, and how should history judge him? His skill as a military officer and his courage as a warrior are undeniable, but his vain, attention-seeking recklessness cannot be ignored, nor his brutality. He played a crucial role in the Union Army's victory in the Civil War, but he suffered perhaps the most infamous defeat in American history. And we're not going to downplay the Indian massacres in which Custer participated. Like many military officers of that time, Custer had some ugly stains on his resume. It was bad, and the Native Americans hated him. So we're not going to glorify George Custer today. Yet despite all this, Custer is a compelling case study in historical leadership that cannot be ignored. He was considered a military genius among his contemporaries, both friends and foes alike. And despite displaying recklessness, brutality, and extreme timidity at times, he inspired undying loyalty among those he led. But does effective leadership in the hierarchy of our world equate good leadership in Jesus' hierarchy? Would George Custer live up to the expectations of the Apostle Paul? Well, let's find out. Because in today's passage, the Apostle Paul painted a portrait of a good Christian leader for his protege, Timothy. So go ahead and take out your Bible and turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. You can also pull up the passage on your smartphone or tablet. And we're going to look at 1 Timothy chapter 3. This is message number 5 of our original series entitled Mission Timpossible, the Timothy Dossier. You may be familiar with the dossier scene from the Mission Impossible franchise. The team leader would sift through the files of different agents available for the mission. Some dossiers he would toss aside, but a few he would choose for the operation. Well, as we've been mentioning the past several weeks, the team leader in the book of 1 Timothy is the Apostle Paul. The mission is to somehow keep together the dysfunctional church in the ancient town of Ephesus that is being splintered by nefarious influences. And the dossier he chooses for this impossible mission is that of a young pastor named Timothy. Timothy was knocked for his youth. He was also a boy general of sorts. And that's okay. Paul could work with a little timidity in a potential leader. But of all the characteristics of a good leader that Paul laid out in today's passage, there was one upon which all others were built. Timothy had it, and maybe you have it too. Let's see if you can pick it out. 1 Timothy chapter 3, starting in verse 1. The Apostle Paul writes, "The saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil. Deacons, likewise, must be dignified, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine, not greedy for dishonest gain. They must hold the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. And let them also be tested first, then let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless. Their wives, likewise, must be dignified, not slanderers, but sober-minded, faithful in all things. Let deacons each be the husband of one wife, managing their children and their own households well. For those who serve well as deacons gain a good standing for themselves and also great confidence in the faith that is in Christ Jesus. I hope to come to you soon, but I am writing these things to you so that, if I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and buttress of the truth. Great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness. He was manifested in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, taken up in glory. Wow, that's quite a list. So it seems safe to assume that none of us are qualified to be Christian leaders. Who here is above reproach all the time? Who here doesn't love money? Who here always has their children under control? This may be the most discouraging passage in all of Scripture. Who could possibly check all these boxes? And as a result, some people never aspire to Christian leadership. They throw up their hands and walk away. It's too much. But others are relieved. They feel let off the hook by this so-called checklist. Whenever someone asks them to lead, they simply point to what they perceive as Paul's job description for Christian leaders and loudly proclaim, "I don't qualify." How can you argue with that? And since they can never meet all these supposed qualifications for leadership, then they feel free to continue in their violent, inhospitable, money-grubbing ways. Isn't it amazing how we can twist God's word to suit our wants? We're kind of messed up, aren't we? But I reject the premise. I think this point of view on this passage betrays a total and complete misunderstanding of what Paul is really telling Timothy. In these descriptors, I do not think Paul is giving Timothy a job description or checklist for aspiring leaders. I don't think this is a rigid set of qualifications. Instead, I believe that Paul is simply painting a portrait of a Christian leader. Paul is sketching out for us what Christian leaders should ideally look like, rather than laying out a specific set of requirements. So before we get into exactly what these individual descriptors mean, we need to establish the ground rules for this passage. This is not a to-do list for elite Christians. This is not a job description that separates the formal church leaders from the rest of us. This is not a how-to manual for conquering timidity in the church. Leadership is more art than science, and Paul is simply painting a picture. He's depicting for us what Christ's church should look like from top to bottom. And that's our main point from today's passage. The main point is this passage is a depiction, not a description. This passage is a depiction, not a job description. So just relax. Stop checking the boxes. This passage shouldn't cripple aspiring leaders with guilt, nor does it let the rest of us off the hook. Instead, this is what we want to look like. This is the idealized vision of ourselves. We don't get discouraged when we look at Jesus, even though we will never be as awesome as he. Instead, his greatness inspires us to be better. But this is more than just a picture of a church leader. This is a depiction of the church. Remember the little word likewise from last week, which meant that the commands directed toward the women and the commands directed toward the men really applied to both parties? Well, we see that exact same linking word this week in verse 8. All the notions that apply to overseers also apply to deacons. So what is an overseer and how is that different from a deacon? Well, I'm not sure either title is meant to be taken as some formal position that gets bestowed upon someone. Things in the early church were very informal. There were no hierarchies. There were no denominations. Each city had a church, and each church had a group of people who rose to leadership from within. So why do we have denominations today? There's no precedent for denominational hierarchies in the Bible. Each church just minded its own affairs, independent of any formal bureaucracy. Leaders simply took care of their own churches, and that seems to be who the overseers were. But then we have what are called deacons. Were the deacons just a lower tier of leaders in the church? Well, not necessarily. Remember, Paul wrote to Timothy in classical Greek, and the original Greek word behind the English translation deacons is not some high office or official title necessarily. In some places, it referred to just a common household servant. Let me show you John chapter 2, verse 9. When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. In other places, this word refers to a minister in the religious sense, but again, it was only one who simply served the church, not necessarily a preacher. Romans 16:1, Paul writes, I command to you, our sister Phoebe, a servant of the church. Now, we have a deacon board at this church, which consists of our overseers, but we are all deacons in some sense. Deacons are simply servants. The title isn't anything special. You see, as we said a few weeks ago, Jesus' hierarchy is upside down. In Jesus' kingdom, leading is serving, and serving is leading. Mark chapter 10, Jesus says, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Same word. And then we see this connecting word likewise again in verse 11. Everything that applies to overseers and deacons also applies to women or wives. This passage is for everyone, but especially for those who aspire to leadership. So we define some of the descriptors in this passage in rapid succession today. Be inspired. Rather than keeping score, get caught up in the beauty of the depiction. Aspire to be better. And to fill in this portrait of a leader with some flesh and blood, we'll see how General Custer measured up in each area. Custer, as effective as he was in some areas, was by no means a Christian leader. And by comparing him and contrasting him with Paul's standard, we can get a better understanding of how worldly leadership compares and contrasts with spiritual leadership. So first of all, Paul told Timothy to be above reproach, or maybe blameless in your translation. And I like this word. It doesn't mean perfect, thank goodness. It means uncatchable. In other words, there's nothing embarrassing going on to be caught in the act doing. Well, that certainly didn't describe George Custer. He received a record-setting 726 demerits at West Point for being caught in the act of doing something stupid. Paul also said that a leader should be the husband of one wife. Now, some have tried to use this to say that divorced people can't serve as leaders and other things like that, but that's a huge stretch. Let's just take this phrase at face value. Literally, it could be translated as a man of one woman. There's one woman in his life, and that's it. It's as simple as that. There's no need to make it complicated. And Custer was a mixed bag in this area. He absolutely adored his wife, Libby. He considered her his soulmate. However, there was rumors that he had an Indian mistress when he was out on the plains. But I'm not going to believe those rumors necessarily, because Custer loved his wife. Once during a particularly difficult time, he was so concerned about her well-being that he went AWOL just to check on her and was court-martialed for it. The depth of their relationship was legendary. Next, Paul says that he should be respectable, the Christian leader. This is the same word for modesty that we saw last week. A leader doesn't try to draw attention to himself by outward means. Well, Custer probably fell pretty short here. He loved being a media personality. He would invite journalists to come along on the missions just for publicity. Then Paul talks about being hospitable. In the original Greek, this is a compound word. Have you ever heard of the term frenemy? It's kind of like that, except it's a combination of the words friend and stranger, or franger, maybe. It's someone who's good at making strangers feel like friends in the church. And Custer probably would have been good at this. He was described as affable and charming, and he made a lifelong friendship with pretty much everywhere he went. Paul also used several terms that show he was cautious of hotheads. Men in particular seem to struggle with this problem, but real men don't yell and scream and blow up all the time. That's what toddlers do. It's a sure sign of timidity. So we have to learn to get angry without losing our cool. And while Custer was known for his emotional outbursts, at least he saw the futility of it. He ordered those under his command to refrain from angry profanity. In his opinion, angry outbursts of blasphemy showed a lack of discipline, although Custer was known to give his men a liberal education in vulgarity from time to time. Paul was also very concerned that his leaders were not drunkards. And Custer was a teetotaler. Unlike his superior Ulysses S. Grant, who was drunk all the time, Custer never drank, and he came down hard on the officers under his command who were taken to drunkenness. And Paul saw the danger of money. If someone loved money, then he simply couldn't be trusted. Early churches often took up collections for the poor, and the people who handled that money had to be of the highest integrity because no one would ever know if they stole some of it. One time, Custer, quote-unquote, confiscated a prized racehorse from a Virginia stable to ride in the victory parade in Washington, D.C. It was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars in today's money. Instead of returning the horse to its rightful owner, as he was ordered to do, he hid the horse so he could ride it later in a race. And then the horse suddenly died, so that's not good. Paul also talked about the importance of overseers not being recent converts. Custer was a very young man when he was put in command, and it seemed to have worked out for his career, but often this is not the case. Timidity believers tend to make commitments that they cannot keep, and when they cannot keep their commitments, the reputation of the church suffers among outsiders. So Paul commanded people to serve for a while before they made any big commitments. He also talked about the family life of both overseers and deacons. They needed to manage their household well. If their children don't respect them, then why should anyone else? Well, George Custer had no children, so I guess he's off the hook for this, but there's something we have to be very careful about here. Men can guide their children, but they cannot control them. Sometimes, no matter how good a father may be, his kids just don't turn out right. And you can't hold this against them. So when you put all this together, we get Paul's portrait of an ideal leader. And it's a good thing that this is merely an ideal depiction of a leader and not a job description, because no one can check all of these boxes. No one displays all of these characteristics all the time. It's simply impossible. But remember when we talked about one characteristic that all effective leaders share? If you look closely at this passage, then you'll find one characteristic upon which all the other traits are built. We may struggle from time to time with our family, our marriage, our respectability, and our hospitality, but there's one characteristic that is foundational and non-negotiable. It's right at the beginning of our passage, and if you blink, you'll miss it. It's so basic that you might not normally recognize it, despite the fact that Paul introduces it with the words, "This saying is trustworthy." Paul simply states at the beginning of this passage, if anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. Paul talks about dignity, drunkenness, family, or money, he makes this comment about aspiring and desiring to lead. True leaders want to lead. This must come first, and it's the basis for everything else. So what exactly does Paul mean by aspiring and desiring to lead? Well, both words have a very strong connotation in the original Greek language. Aspire means to reach for something. In some places, it's even translated as covet. It's used to talk about an unhealthy longing for money. 1 Timothy 6:10, Paul writes, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." And this word's also used about a unhealthy or a healthy longing for heaven. Hebrews 11:16, it says, "But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one." And so this word is very powerful. And desire in this passage has an even more powerful connotation. Look how it's used elsewhere to describe crippling hunger. Luke 16:21, it says, "He desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table." Look how it's used to describe burning lustfulness. In Matthew 5:28, Jesus says, "But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent," there's the word, "has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And so this is a very potent word as well. And while the other characteristics of a leader may wane, this one seems to be immutable among all true leaders, even those who display some timidity. Leaders have a burning desire to lead, which in the Christian context means they have a burning desire to serve. And that's our application from today's passage. The application is first, thirst. First comes thirst or desire to lead. Before all else, leaders want to lead. Leaders hunger and thirst to serve people. As Peter says in 1 Peter 5:2, "Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you." Here's a story of how Custer first responded to the news that he had been promoted to brigadier general. After a long day of scouting in the pouring rain, he slogged into camp, and here's how the story is retold. Custer found most of the men still there, lounging about, smoking, telling stories, and pleasantly whiling away the hours. But as soon as they saw him, all bedlam broke loose. "Hello, General," roared one officer. Another, snapping to attention and delivering a mock salute, announced, "Gentlemen, General Custer." From every corner of the tent, similar irreverent greeting tumbled from malicious grins. "You're looking well, General. How are you, General?" "Why, General, I congratulate you." Custer loved a good joke as well as any man, and his sense of humor was usually inexhaustible. But tonight he was drenched, beat, and in no mood for silly games. "You may laugh, boys," he spat back brusquely. "Laugh as long as you please, but I will be a general yet for all your chaff. You see if I don't, that's all." This sincere little speech reduced the occupants of that tent to hysterics, which only pushed Custer's temper to the breaking point. His eyes narrowed and then flashed with anger. But before he could act, Lieutenant George W. Yates, a close hometown friend from Monroe, shook off his mirth and said, "Look on the table, old fellow, they're not chafing." Turning around, he picked up a large official envelope and read the inscription. Instantly, he felt his knees give way and his eyes fill with tears, and all he could do was sink into a camp stool, still grasping the unopened envelope. It was addressed to Brigadier General George A. Custer. The aides were still laughing, but now they were crowding around to slap his back, shake his hand, and offer their heartfelt congratulations. It was all Custer could do to keep from crying and making an utter fool of himself. You see, General Custer may have been controversial. He had some major flaws and blind spots in his character. But for all his faults, it cannot be denied that men followed him. And men followed him because he hungered and thirsted to lead them. For all the things we should reject about Custer's leadership, this is one area we should learn from. There's nothing wrong with wanting to lead. Paul said that to aspire to leadership is to desire a good thing. No one is ever forced into leadership as a Christian. No one should ever be forced to do anything in the church. And really, no one is qualified for this tremendous responsibility. Show me someone who is consistent in all of these areas. There's none. But all God needs is desire. Anyone who has a burning desire to serve, God can work with. But no amount of natural leadership ability can make up for a lack of desire. Leadership is hard. You'll fail time and time again. You'll be criticized and second-guessed. There's no real money in it, and there's no real prestige. The only thing that keeps you going is a love for the people and a desire to serve them. Otherwise, you'll crash and burn shortly after you start. Listen, I know what I'm talking about. A thirst to serve should be the first thing we look for in leaders. Forget the high-powered executive types. Forget the charismatic personalities. Give me a blue-collar guy who actually wants to be there. God can work with a guy who's got a temper. God can work with a guy who makes mistakes and fails time and time again. God can work with a guy who struggles with timidity. But if he doesn't really want to be there, then there's not much God can do for him. This passage is not a job description for church leaders. It's Paul's ideal depiction of the church. But none of these descriptors matter much if first there's no thirst. Unfortunately, as we'll see next week, not all church leaders have this desire to serve their people. And Paul predicted that their selfishness is only going to get worse as time goes on. But we don't have to participate. So read 1 Timothy 4 this week and come back next Sunday as we learn how to become Tim Movable.